you know, you kind of see areas where there is no real estate investment going on. Certainly, we have plenty of those in New Jersey. You see the downside of not investing in real estate because the areas become eyesores and are in dire needs of funding.
Welcome to the Real Estate Professional Status Podcast. Join me as I sit down with the tax experts and real estate investors to learn how you can qualify for the real estate professional status and how you can use it to amplify your real estate investments. My name is Usher Fried. Let's get right to it.
My name is Carolus Matulis. I'm with Wilkin & Gumplant. I'm a CPA, a CVA, a manager at the firm, chair of the firm's Innovation Council. My biggest niche at the firm is real estate, so I'm happy to join Asher here today to talk all things real estate, and hopefully folks can kind of walk away with some gems. So
thank you, Carolus, for coming on the show and giving us some insight.
Yep.
And most people, I believe, listen to this while they're driving, so hopefully they'll drive away with some insight. If they're walking, you know, then that's also fine.
They'll walk away with some insight. Either way, the hope is that folks are coming away with something. Yeah, I'm a big listening in the car guy also, as far as podcasts go. So
yeah, just have it on, you know, subscribe to a couple of shows and just press play and whatever goes on, you know, just let it roll. Could you tell us more about your clientele? What kind of investors are they and how you help them?
Yeah, absolutely. So actually, when you kind of reached out to me initially, you had wanted to talk about the, you know, real estate professional status, and folks that I tend to work with are generally, there's really no question about their real estate status. Typically, you know, they're operating large groups, kind of syndicators or closely held real estate groups. Sometimes folks are kind of aggregating, you know, large pools of investor money and are kind of running the show there. I think the big takeaway for me, you know, jumping into this career is how real estate, you know, just like everybody's financial journey, kind of differs depending on the stage in life that folks are in. People kind of tend to go through an accumulation phase. And, you know, they might be kind of enjoying the depreciation and the cost eggs and all of those things that go along with it, you know, maybe depending on how they're financing things or, you know, how they're capitalizing the purchases. The other side that we kind of tend to see is as folks are sunsetting or kind of approaching the end of their investing life, you know, maybe depreciation is starting to run out. And maybe now they're starting to think about how to pass on the wealth to the next generation and kind of not incur the hated estate tax. There's optimizations to be had on the tax front in various stages of the wealth building and investing life cycle.
So first off, just to point out what you said, the real estate professional status is something that obviously everyone you're helping with qualifies for, but some people, you know, have no chance of getting the status. Some people get it without blinking twice and they don't have to worry about getting audited, because if they do, it's like literally what they do the whole day, you know, syndications, people in construction that are also investing. To clarify, you mostly deal with people running syndications and that's what they do full time.
Yeah. I mean, they're kind of operating, they have a management company and they operate large portfolios of real estate, right. Whether or not it's capitalized internally with, you know, closely held group, or it's kind of capitalized, you know, with some of their own money and external money through common investors or preferred investors. That's kind of, it runs the gamut depending on who we're talking about and the kind of investing they're doing and where in their investing life they're, right. they're at. Because those priorities do change and can change. And what you're optimizing for does change over time.
Right. So now the people that are running syndications, the only obstacle they potentially could have is the material participation. Because you could be running syndications 24/7, but if you know, have property managers, like you said, and you're not involved in the operation, the physical operation of the property, you're lacking that. So is that something that people have to be conscious of, or like, is it just automatically included in the day-to-day work of just running the buildings?
I think that the challenge is that you can often get lost in the sauce in terms of trying to read what the rules are. Try to read the case law. The facts are never the same between two individuals. So the case law is not always entirely applicable. Sometimes it's applicable, but maybe it's applicable in a particular jurisdiction. The court circuit system in Texas looks a lot different than the court system here in the Northeast. Given the same facts, they might come up with different conclusions. I like to kind of look at all of these issues as practically as possible and say, you know, would a reasonable person, you know, say that this individual who is maybe operating their real estate empire through, you know, management companies somehow indirectly, but this is the only kind of job that they have. You know, they don't have a W-2 job anywhere else. They don't have any other skills. The only thing that they do is kind of in real estate. And if we're just kind of trying to follow all the bright line tests, maybe that's not the conclusion that we reach. But to me, that's not a conclusion that a reasonable person would kind of reach under the circumstances without kind of regard for all the bright line rules. So I think in tax, you have to be reasonable. You got to make sure that you're not being outrageous. You have to kind of understand that the facts are always going to be differing. You just got to make sure that it makes sense to a reasonable person. Obviously, you're not going to make a statement that somebody that works 2,200 hours a year as a CPA is also a real estate professional, because how would a reasonable person kind of spend their time running real estate when they're already tied up in another job?
Right. So I think you make a very important point that, let me just first make sure I'm understanding you correctly. You're basically saying that they might not hit every, you know, official tax law rule, but let's sit back, look at the bigger picture. Is it reasonable that they are a real estate professional because their entire lives are involved in real estate and operating properties? Do they maybe hit 400 hours and hours that count? Maybe. And they don't hit the 500 hour test? Maybe. But reasonably speaking, all the people you're dealing with are real estate professionals because this is just what they do. So hitting the test, the paper test, the official test is not as important as just looking at the picture, seeing if it's reasonable that they are real estate professionals, right? The flip side of that is people trying to qualify for the real estate professional status who may hit the tests, but aren't reasonable, but they're lacking that reasonability. They're lacking that practicality that you're speaking of. They are still at risk of potentially losing, because even though they could go ahead and point to all the hours clocked in, if it doesn't look reasonable, they might lose. They could get a few hours discounted here and there because it's so great, and then all of a sudden they're losing. And that would be the flip side. Anyone trying to get the status, to keep that in mind, you want to make your case reasonable.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the big thing is your mileage is going to vary depending on, you know, sometimes you get a IRS agent who is what we'll call a reasonable person, and we'll look at the facts as presented and say, you know what, there's nothing to be had here. And sometimes you get IRS agents that I guess are a bit more by the books and are looking to cross their checklist, and their checklists are very specific in terms of what they're supposed to look for. And they don't look to deviate from that checklist. That's just kind of the reality, that just as taxpayer facts differ, your experience with the IRS and examinations will differ. And then obviously, if you don't get an answer that you like from that examiner, there's ways to escalate it. Like I said before, you know, you might even have different mileage in terms of which tax court you go to. You know, you might have a judge or take a look at the facts and say, you know, there's nothing here. Let's not waste anybody's time. And then, you know, you might have instances where folks kind of want to go down these rabbit holes. So I think at the end of the day, you want to make sure that you're getting to the standard that you want to get to, and that you're not making kind of leaps of logic to get there that don't really add up.
I actually interviewed an ex-IRS auditor, audited a lot of reps, rep status, and he told me that he would have cases where he thought it was okay. And he would go to his manager and tell the manager, everything here looks clean. I think we're ready. Just give them the kosher sign and let's move on. And the manager says, no, keep at it.
Yep.
he said, I believe that this guy is clean. He's a real estate professional. He meets all the rules. And my manager says, nope, keep going. It was very interesting to speak to him because he hated the IRS more than us, let's just say.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point. Sometimes the examiner, the frontline examiner, is kind of stuck in this between a rock and a hard place. The taxpayer and their kind of superiors who are looking to get to a particular answer. and that answer is not the right one, but they're just kind of told to keep at it. And then, right. You know, it's not something that they enjoy. You know, I've spoken with examiners. They're like, hey, this is what my supervisor is telling me. This is what I got to do. At the end of the day, everybody's just trying to do the best job they can, the tools that they have. I think if you approach those interactions appropriately, a lot of times you can kind of break through whatever walls are being put in front of you.
All right. Focusing, you said that you have two kinds of clients, one that are looking to accumulate and ones that are looking to sunset. Let's focus on the clients that are looking to accumulate. What does your average client look like? What kinds of investments is he pursuing? And is it every type of investment? Is it specific niche? And how do you, let's say as the CPA, how are you directing him and guiding him through that process?
Yeah. So for us, you know, typically they're multi-million dollar projects that folks are kind of tackling. Some are acquiring properties that are in need of kind of rehab. Some are buying properties and knocking them down and building towers in the middle of cities that, you know, cost tens of millions of dollars. And then some are looking to add a property here and there to their portfolio. The way that folks typically approach real estate investing is one bite at a time. So you figure out how to do the next deal, you figure out how to finance it, you figure out how to get it up and running. And then once that's done, you kind of move on to the next one. So depending on where folks are in their accumulation process, they might have 30, 40, 50 properties, or they might have two or three. In our experience, we kind of see the gamut of properties, what we'll call mixed use in cities where, you know, the first and the second floor are kind of commercial. These folks need to have commercial experience to make sure that those spaces are filled up with appropriate tenants. The upper floors consisting of residential, you know, we have folks that deal exclusively in residential, you know, whether it's kind of more upper scale type of, you know, Gold Coast properties or lower quality. And by quality, I just mean from a real estate standpoint, properties that are for lower earning families, and then industrial and anywhere in between. So it's interesting to observe real estate in motion, because I think a lot of times folks don't appreciate or the improvements that these real estate developers bring to areas. To me, that seems to be quite a interesting way to observe the real estate market. There's not always kind of high income tax bills, or at least the public perceives the real estate operators not to have high income tax bills. But I think the public needs to kind of recognize the fact that, you know, a lot of these real estate developers are actually improving the surroundings of the areas that they work in. The tax revenue from their projects is in the form of real estate tax more so than income tax. The income tax comes later when the depreciation and all of those qualities run their course.
You know, you're emphasizing a fantastic point that I don't think could be emphasized enough, that people in real estate aren't getting away with not paying taxes. It's an incentive to motivate them to keep building and developing. And like you're seeing it from a large scale, these developers putting up towers in Manhattan or just redeveloping communities, you know, the opportunity zone incentive that, you know, I know it's complex. I don't know if we'll get into it. But the point is, it's to incentivize people to build so the average guy could live a better life, right? Nicer, yeah. Newer properties that are more effective, that are more efficient, that are operating nicely. People complain that the rich, you know, don't pay taxes, and they also complain that their toilet in their apartment is not getting fixed, right? So we want people, I mean, sometimes the guys are investing in real estate and also not fixing the toilet.
Yeah. But
we are trying to get good people to pursue real estate so we could live better as a society.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you kind of see areas where there is no real estate investment going on. Certainly, we have plenty of those in New Jersey. Some of that may be benefiting over time from things like the qualified opportunity zone. But, you know, I think for the most part, if those projects have not been started, I think that program has effectively been sunset in terms of starting projects. You know, maybe we'll see something like that come back. But you see the downside of not investing in real estate because the areas become eyesores and are in dire needs of funding. You know, the one thing that our firm does see kind of outside of this that I think is a great conversation to have is kind of the pilot program within New Jersey.
specific to New Jersey, right?
Yeah. Well, so a lot of states have something like this, but the way the pilot program works, and I'm not an expert, but we have some experts at the firm. Effectively, you're able to approach townships and say, look, there is some property or area in your town that, you know, is in need of redevelopment. We're kind of doing the numbers here, and the numbers don't really work because, you know, the cost of development, the cost of materials, you know, labor, all those that go into the project don't make it feasible compared to the revenue that this building is going to generate. What the townships can kind of offer are incentives on the real estate tax side to reduce the real estate tax for a period of 5 years, 10 years, whatever it might be, where you kind of approach the town and you are able to get beneficial terms on the real estate tax side to kind of make the project feasible to develop. And then kind of with that, there's a pilot agreement that goes into place with the township. And then the township generally requires, you know, some sort of sign off by a CPA that the real estate tax calculations are appropriate based on the terms of the agreement. So we do help folks who kind of have these agreements in place to stay current with the townships that they're working with.
Interesting. So it seems to me that this initiative covers the downside of going to such an area, but where's the upside, right? It's sort of, is the numbers making sense alone the upside? Because you want a big upside. You don't want just the numbers to make sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of times these projects we'll call bundled with other things, whether, you know, it's affordable housing, whether it's qualified opportunity zone, whether it's, you know, something of that sort, where there's another multiplier in there or another way to capitalize on the project that makes it make a bit more sense than it did before. You know, we see this in New Jersey. There are areas in New Jersey that are not developed. And the reason for it is, you know, even when you kind of consider these programs, the numbers don't work.
Right, right. So this is why it's important for everyone listening to do what you're doing, enjoy the tax benefits, and also feel amazing about yourself because you're really helping develop the world and move, you know, America forward. Who doesn't want a world without a better America, right? So it's not cheating the system, you know, it's really playing into the system and leveraging the system. Real estate is all about leverage, right? You leverage the banks with the loan, you leverage the depreciation, now you're leveraging the tax incentives and it overlaps with depreciation. Okay, very interesting. In your opinion, did the qualified opportunity zones make sense? Did they work according to plan?
So I think it's too early to tell. For the most part, we'll call it the initial.
I mean, let's start with what a qualified opportunity zone is. I guess somebody doesn't know.
So let's kind of get folks up to speed on that. Yeah. So the qualified opportunity zone were legislation that came out through the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in 2017. And what it effectively did was create, based on, I think it's FEMA maps or some sort of economic maps, that there are areas of the United States that are in need of redevelopment. And what the legislation did was, to the extent that you invest money into projects in these zones, any money that was invested could be used to offset gains in a particular year. So let's take 2019 or 2020 as an example. Let's say in 2020, you had a lot of capital gains, either through your portfolio gains or through, you know, you sold a property or whatever the case might be, and you had $1 million of capital gains. What you were able to do was then to take $1 million and put it into one of these qualified opportunity zones and effectively wipe out the gain from your 2020 tax bill. The $1 million that you kind of offset would come back over time at a particular percentage. I don't recall the percentages exactly, but you effectively had to kind of, it deferred the gain over a period of years and reduced it if you held your investment in the qualified opportunity zone. And then you were able to kind of get a step up in basis to your investment and all kinds of upside in that way. So I do think that it was, you know, I've had folks that took that road and, you know, used the provisions to shield some of the gains in early years, and those tax bills will be coming up at a reduced rate later. I think if you think about time value of money for these folks, even if it's a complete wash, that's probably a good way to go about it. But coupled with some of the other provisions in there, I think it will probably be a good program for most folks. I always say, not necessarily disregard, but don't let the tail wag the dog. Don't just invest in the qualified opportunity zone just to make use of this provision. If it doesn't make sense to make that investment, do that project. You want to make sure that you're doing projects for the right reasons. And if there are things that kind of help your tax bill at the same time, then do that. But don't let the tax element steer your investment strategy.
Right. Appreciation, cash flow, and then depreciation. Don't invest in any property just for the tax benefits. Depreciation as an example over here, we're dealing with the QO zones, qualified opportunity zones. Always make sure the investment makes sense. Okay, very interesting. So you're saying that you've seen that people, you believe, right? It's too early to tell, but you do believe that people will be seeing a nice return from the fact that they were able to defer the taxes on these specific investments. Depreciation with cost segregation and the bonus depreciation, that's also getting phased out now as we say goodbye to a lot of the 2017 benefits that came. Bonus depreciation and cost segregation has limits that were implemented and just activated. Excessive business loss, EBL, which limits it for a married person, 578 this year, and for single, I think 279. You know, for a lot of people, they're making under $500,000, so they're fine. It sounds like your clients are going to be running into this obstacle. What strategies do you guys have in your back pocket, or what possible workarounds are there? Or is it just something you can't avoid?
So obviously, I think in social media, the cost segregations are always shown as a complete slam dunk. And in some ways, you know, I agree with that. But in other ways, I like to try to toe the balance between kind of running somebody's real estate portfolio at a loss, at a tax loss, because it doesn't matter if it's negative 1 million or negative 10, the tax bill is still zero. So there's no point in running up the score into the negatives, because as you said, you know, you're not able to even deduct or you're not able to get benefits for losses in excess of 500,000. I think that's the number. But yeah, there's no reason to run up the scoreboard in the negative direction. So timing out depreciation, making the bonus election on certain assets, not making the bonus election on certain assets is certainly a lever that you can use. At the end of the day, depreciation, folks kind of think of it as a free lunch. It's not really a free lunch. You know, the one thing that we didn't really talk about was folks sunsetting their portfolio. And to the extent that they've been taking all the depreciation and growing that snowball, and at a particular point in their career, not adding to the snowball, the depreciation runs out and then the tax bills start to come in. I think it's important to think of depreciation as kind of a timing issue. In accounting, we talk about this all the time. It's not that you are, you know, foregoing income or expenses. It's the question of timing the income and expenses, because they are going to occur. It's just a question of when. A lot of times what we see, you know, as folks are approaching the sunset phase, they all of a sudden kind of have this realization that they're in excess of the estate tax cap. And for your listeners that are not familiar, is I think the number is 13 million per person. If you're a married couple, you have an estate tax exemption of 26 million. But if you've built up your real estate portfolio to, I don't know, 80 million, 100 million, what that really means is you're paying 40% tax on the excess over 26 million. So the key is to kind of realize that I'm about to go off the cliff here. And the sooner that I realize that the estate tax is a cliff that I will have to manage, then you can kind of take the steps to try to manage that issue earlier rather than later, because the later that you try to manage it, the more difficult it is, and more likely it is that you'll be paying some level of estate tax. So even if you've foregone kind of paying income tax, you know, your entire investing career, you might run into an issue where you're paying 40% estate tax on your real estate portfolio.
Is that once you die or even when you're still alive?
That is once you die. So
once you die.
Good news is we're not going to have to worry about it if
your kids caught, might, right?
But your kids might. So there's certainly strategies and things that you want to be doing to make sure that, right, you know, your kids are not left with a tax bill. That the other side that, you know, real estate folks run into in those instances is often there's not a great deal of liquidity in their estate. And if you have a tax bill of 20, 30 million, you're not able to
pay it without selling it. Right.
Yeah, without actually selling properties. You got to make sure that you're planning for that inevitability.
Right. But there are strategies for the estate tax. I think an irrevocable trust, I have some familiarity with it, would shield a lot of it from an estate tax.
Yeah. Yeah. So trusts are kind of the number one tool. And there's many, many different flavors of trusts. And depending on the types of assets that you have, you can kind of utilize the trusts in different ways.
Right.
You know, the earlier that you're kind of aware of it, the more flexibility that you have. Trusts, I've actually seen life insurance policies used to great effect.
Right.
In terms of funding the estate tax bill when the estate tax bill. So the life insurance policy is just there to provide liquidity for the estate tax bill, more so than for anything else. So you can kind of maintain ownership of the real estate to the extent that you know that you're going to have a estate bill.
Right. The first point you made, if you're not paying any money in taxes, and even if, let's say, you're in the 12% bracket, you don't have to cross-seg until you don't have to pay taxes for millions of years, right? What's the point? You know, don't pay for the study and keep that cash in your pocket. You're paying $0 in tax anyways. But in regards to this, the last point, so is that a reason to not cross-seg and not, you know, further depreciate your assets? Or is that a reason just to be cognizant of it and make sure that you have the other end, the sunsetting end covered, let's just say?
I think if you're going to run up the score in the negatives, it probably doesn't make sense to. If you are going to kind of utilize the deductions in the near term, then it probably makes sense to do the cost seg. I think it makes sense on that front.
Right.
And then depending on the size of the real estate portfolio and kind of how it's capitalized, there's another threshold that is of like particular nuisance to real estate operators. And that's the interest expense limitation rules that kind of kick in around $29 million of receipts, or, you know, rents or revenues, whatever you want to call it. And then that becomes an issue to kind of manage also. But I also kind of view it as another lever to utilize in terms of trying to toe the line between, you know, large negative income numbers and positive income numbers. So then you kind of have, you know, multiple tools through the depreciation timing and the interest expense limitation rules to kind of make sure that you're staying in the green.
Right, right. So someone's making $1 million, let's just say, and they want to take $1 million loss. Is there any like practical advice you could give to get around this? Or is it just, there's nothing to do?
Well, so I think it depends on, you know, and tax land, $1 million of income.
Sounds like a fun place, by the way, tax land.
Yeah, tax land. Tax land is a fun place for some, but it's a pretty painful place for most.
Yeah.
But I think $1 million of income is not necessarily $1 million of income, because you have a question of character. So in tax land, income falls into many different buckets. You know, you could have your kind of ordinary compensation income, something on W-2 income. So if you have $1 million of W-2 income, then you have $1 million of W-2 income. There's not a whole lot that you can do.
It is what it is.
Yeah. Especially, I mean, it is what it is. It's not a bad place to be. but it certainly doesn't give you a lot of flexibility from kind of a tax planning point of view.
Right.
But if you're in a driver's seat on kind of your real estate portfolio, you may be able to plan the character of the income. So obviously ordinary W-2 income is, we'll call it the lowest on the totem pole, because it's taxed at the highest rate. But, you know, maybe there are things that you can do to have the income be capital in nature, where, you know, you're paying capital gain rates instead of ordinary rates, which...
Right. What's the next bucket after W-2? Could we go through all the buckets? Are there...
There's more buckets than we can cover in the program, but I would say right. The big ones are, so ordinary, and then we'll call kind of passive passive income, passive real estate income, passive income from, you know, other investments. Then you have active investments and active income. And then you kind of have the preferred rate income, which would be dividends and capital gains.
Right. What about like 1099 and just like other forms of getting paid besides W-2?
Yeah, so 1099 is probably somewhere in between W-2 and passive. So 1099 would typically put you into the Schedule C filer bucket. And then, you know, there's obviously an opportunity to deduct necessary and ordinary business expenses against it.
But right, but does the 1099 help with the excessive business loss? I don't, for some reason, I thought it did.
No, I mean, I think that the way to manage that limitation, I think, is just to minimize your overall income.
Right, meaning spread it into other areas.
Yeah, yeah. It's just you gotta squish down your overall income, because if you don't, then if you can only take $500,000 of losses, then anything in excess is typically going to be.
Are you going to be right? So basically, people, if they don't want to pay taxes, the max money they can make is $578,000.
The maximum taxable income that they can have is $500,000.
$500,000, right? Which is not a lot. I'll take that. But at the same time, it's not millions of dollars, right? So anyone who's making millions of dollars will be taxed. There's no way to get out of it, from what you understand.
Yeah, that's probably
correct, right? Somebody asked me in a podcast what I'm looking forward to in 2024. I said, pleasantly surprising people that bought properties in 2022 and before that they get 100% bonus depreciation.
Yeah.
That's what I'm looking forward to.
Well, 80% is pretty good. I don't know.
80% is solid, but that's sunsetting to 60%.
Yeah.
It's just a different product. That's all it is. You know, it's a different product for a different clientele. It's no longer the guy that's looking to get a, you know, one investment property and not get his whole income. It's going to be people in real estate that are accumulating investments. It's going to be the old CoreSeg eventually, you know, layering different properties, and you get five or six properties, you're not paying income for the next 5 years.
That's the baseline. We've been enjoying the 100% for the last, was it 5-6 years? Before then, people were very happy with that.
People are very happy, but now like a whole new kind of investor got involved in it and took advantage of it. And now all of those guys are gone, unless they use the time to actually build up real investment, a real portfolio, then they could continue to, you know, to take advantage. But yeah, 100%. It's just a different product. Thank you so much, Carolus, for coming on. We touched on heavy topics. Pleasure. Very informative, and I'm sure everyone will enjoy their drive listening to this stimulating conversation in the background. How could anyone reach out to you if they would like to? Are you reachable?
I am reachable. Smoke signal, fax, any of that works. For folks that are a bit more modern, LinkedIn or email, you can reach out to me there on LinkedIn. I'm /KMATULIS. And then my email is kmatulis@wgcpas.com. So
got it. All right. I'll put the information in the show notes so people could easily access. You were a pleasure speaking with, and I definitely gained a lot of knowledge in many different areas.